This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Clue dispensing.
The Killingest Saints.
And my Strand Books book haul. I'm Ken.
And I'm Robin.
And we're talking about stuff. Specifically, Robin, we're talking about a phenomenon that occurs every January. No, not the sudden surge in gym memberships that vanishes by the Ides of March, but something far more transformative for the tabletop landscape.
You mean New Game Master Month, Ken, the time when we take the uninitiated, those who've spent their lives safely on the player's side of the screen, and gently push them into the glorious yet terrifying spotlight of the Game Master's chair.
It's a transition more profound than any alchemical transmutation. And this year, for those who want their first foray into GMing to be as approachable as a warm sunbeam, Magical Kitties Save the Day is a featured game.
It's the perfect starting point for new GMs. While you and I can spend hours debating the occult significance of 19th century Parisian sewers, some people just want to play a really cute kitty who can throw fireballs.
And let's be honest, Robin, compared to some of the eldritch horrors we've summoned in the consulting occultist hut, a hyper-intelligent raccoon is a refreshingly manageable antagonist.
Exactly. If you've been pausing...
Oh no, here we go.
If you've been pausing before taking the leap, New Game Master Month provides a free step-by-step seminar starting in January at newgamemastermonth.com. It's a series of twice-weekly posts that guide you through every moment of preparation.
You get expert advice, a supportive community, and an easy entry game designed to be run by those who find a 400-page rule book a bit
hysterical.
I was not going to say that. No.
By February, you'll be an actual GM. It really is the cat's pajamas of intro workshops. So don't let your New Year's resolutions be a tale of woe.
Go to newgamemastermonth.com to sign up for the totally free seminar.
And remember, in the world of Magical Kitties Save the Day, the only thing more powerful than your magic is your personality.
I'm ending the segment now, Robin.
Fair, I think I used up my 9 lives on that last one.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more to the Gaming Hut. And today in the Gaming Hut, we are, looks like our books are gumshoe books, but they don't have to be. But the question is, do the players earn the clue in a mystery scenario, or even in a dungeon scenario, if the clue is there's a secret door here, or this was built by evil dwarves, not good happy dwarves, whatever it is, somehow that knowledge has to get from the head of the GM, or the pages of the scenario, into the minds of the players. And that can be tricky if it's just you've learned the clue, congratulations, move on. You want to gussy it up a little bit, and gussying is what we're all about in this segment, right?
Right. So there's two kinds of clues. There's the core clue, as we call it in Gumshoe, which is the clue that we absolutely need to get to the player interface for the story to move on. So, you know, the classic example I always use is you find the clue telling you that you need to go to the old mill, because the old mill is where the next chunk of the adventure is. And then there's flavor clues, things that are more fun to have, that create dimension, that make the players feel that they're part of a world. And I would submit to you that having them miss a lot of flavor clues is also a problem, because that's fun, right? It's interesting, yeah, to get flavor. It's not interesting to have it withheld from you. But if you miss a certain percentage of those clues that add a texture, that's fine as long as you get enough of them and as long as everybody is having fun. If you miss a clue that is necessary to get you further into the adventure, that is a problem. And so Gumshoe, of course, solves the problem of the failed roll that prevents the players from getting the clue. But how does it make sure that they get the clue nonetheless? So one of the issues, of course, is that players can fail to look in the right place, or they can, you know, get distracted. And so you do not want to feel that you're putting the thumb on the scale and that it's just the GM narrating it to you. You want them to feel a sense of accomplishment. That means they need to do something, or at least you need to describe their characters doing something. And that's what we're talking about here. And so the first tip that I would give that's above all the others is don't forestall the players from finding the thing. Be patient and give them time to look in the right place and apply the right investigative ability before you even have to ask yourself this question. And you may get a little impatient waiting for them to find the thing that you want them to find. But first of all, give them time to do it naturally or on their own is the most important piece of advice. And everything else we're going to talk about here is a fallback when that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Part of the key to any role-playing game, clue or no clue, is to have enough going on that the characters feel like people and the world feels like a world. And if that's going on, then you, the GM, shouldn't mind that maybe they're doing a little role playing, or they're doing a little politics, or they're doing a little exploration, or they're doing whatever else they're doing besides finding the clue that will get them to the old mill, or finding the clue that will inform them that evil dwarves built the old mill, or whatever else it is, because the rest of the world should be engaging. And if you, the GM, are bored by any part of your world, that is on you, I would argue. And so it is incumbent on you, even as a zeroth rule, to make doing nothing as interesting and fun as you can, such that it doesn't feel like a punishment to the players that they are forced to interact with your world or with each other. That's the goal of role-playing, is to make existing in that world fun and interesting.
But now we get to the part of the problem where they've done all the interacting, all the banter, they've given up trying to find things in the room, and they're about to leave, but they have yet to find the scroll that tells them that the evil dwarves have created the portal. And so What do you do then? And one example is just to give them a bit of a hint and say, on the way out the door, and you look at the player who has, dwarven lore, if that's how they find the clue, or notice suspicious hidden cabinets, if that's the way they get the clue. And you just, you have the feeling, you know drawers, and you have a picture of a drawer in your head. There's something about this place that it isn't quite done with you, so that you can essentially, in a more interesting way than just going, there's still a clue here, but in narrative mode and in the heads of the characters and in world, suggest to them that there's still something to be found. So that is the complex strategy known as the hint, but it's a gussied up hint. It's a hint that is also fun to receive. It's not a hint that makes them feel dumb for missing something. So you don't go, you didn't look everywhere, did you? But rather, you are creating fun, interesting narration that renews the sense of fun about this location that then motivates them to continue doing something. So essentially, you're trying to give them a Columbo moment, except instead of, excuse me, just one more question, it's, excuse me, hey, drawer over there, I bet there's something in you.
And you can deliver that hint in any number of different ways. It can, ideally, it will have arisen organically from whatever the byplay was in the room. So if they were dickering with the butler, and then they decide there's nothing in the room and they're about to leave, the character, either the cabinet making character or the face, can notice the butler. A moment of relief passes across his face as though he's glad to have gotten rid of you, and his eyes steal to that weirdly ornate desk. And now that came out of play. If it can't come out of play, it should come, as you say, out of the character. So one of the characters is an expert in dwarven cabinetry. You notice that cabinet by the door just as you're leaving is of dwarven make, but it's slightly different from other dwarven cabinets that you've seen, a little thicker in the back, perhaps. And then that, hopefully, as you say, drops the hint. But the hint should ideally come organically, either out of the scene that you've just played or out of the character capacity. And at the sort of the final extremis, you can, have a character who's just, you bang your hip against the cabinet on your way out and it echoes weird. And that is, the sort of the final level. But even then, you're not saying, you dummy, you've missed a clue, here it is. You're hopefully saying, a thing has happened, now respond to it in the world, and that will create fun.
Right. And if you go through both of those stages, the waiting and letting them figure it out stage and the hint stage, and it's still somehow not quite getting to the player interface, you can then come right out and say it, because that's the result of not saying it is much more annoying than the result of saying it. So even if, you know, in theory, someone might go, okay, well, we've been handed this clue. At this point, they're frustrated too. And they're going, okay, finally, yeah, sure. Right. Give me the clue. Let me keep moving.
I mean, I suppose the other possibility is if you know where the next scene is and the clue is suitable to be moved, you could move it to the next scene if they don't need to go right to the mill next time.
Right.
But they're going to the next room in the house. You just move the cabinet into the other house, and that's the other room. And that's the first thing they see is, that's odd, a weird dwarven cabinet. It's so out of place here in the sunroom.
A shaft of light is coming down from the skylight and it's illuminating the cupboard, and okay, yeah, sure. But the other thing is, sometimes you just don't have an idea of where to move it to. And so what you can do then, if you're stumped, you can just finally, at the end of it, this is dragging out too long. There is no shame in actually telling them, but you can tell them in a way that still seems empowering, right? Is you can give them the answer in the way that, yeah, maybe you, the players, didn't quite wend your way through the verbal thicket that I created for you, but your character still knows. So you can just finally say, oh, and your expertise in dwarven cabinetry finally kicks in. You see a bunch of flashes in your head of other hidden dwarven cabinets that you've encountered over the years. You remember your father showing you the secret compartment in a dwarven cabinet. It reminds you of the good old days, that a sense of nostalgia permeates you, and you see, oh, look, that drawer over there is just like the one that reminds you of your father. And you've accomplished a certain amount of ledger domain, because again, the just like the hint was evocative, the finally just flat out giving them the answer is also evocative. But there are many times when players will be more anxious to just get on with it than they will for you to be fully disguising the essential GM player informational relationship. And you can just, you know, at the end of the day, dress it up, compliment them, make them seem smart, or in that case, you know, have a positive memory, something that is fun to take away from this, as well as just here's the clue, right? That you don't do that. You also step a bit more into character viewpoint narration than you normally would, but you still make it evocative and fun that they got this information.
And you can also make it a little more interactive by saying to the character with the dwarven dad, you say, hey, Gabdor, why don't you just real quick share a memory of your dad and his cabinetry, and tell us something that he showed you that he told you to keep secret from people, that it was going to be an important thing that you would know, and that no talls would ever find out. And then maybe you can lure the character into giving you that exact memory. But if not, you can say, yes, that was a beautiful time. Just as beautiful as the time he told you about secret doors and cabinets. What a time that was. And then you're doing the same thing, but you've invited the player to feed you a little more of it and made them a co-creator of this increasingly obviously dropped hint. But they co-created it, so they still own it a little bit.
Right. And speaking of things that create a sense of ownership, all of the listeners to this podcast feel a great sense of connection and ownership to the exciting commercials that we put in our show. So now's your chance to experience one of those and another hut and or segment on the other side of it.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth breadth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
jazz age ambition and glamour,
a childhood haunted by strife and a shadowy being,
deceit and survival on the spaceship Earth again.
A stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement.
The screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the music drama in the LA punk scene.
The arrival of a telepathic stranger on a space-bound way station.
Tragic love between a vampire and a mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
It's time once more to head back into the past. This time, we're going to head into a windswept, desolate, island-based past, or often peninsula-based past, and one in which we're going to examine the dichotomy between being a saint and killing a lot of people and or getting them killed. Because, Ken, I put a question before you, and I think this is a great example of your successfully answering an abstruse, difficult-to-research question. And that question is there a saint with a higher body count than Olaf? And he came bringing not peace, but a sword. And he used that sword to stab a guy, and then he used that sword to stab another guy, and then another guy after that, and a bunch of other guys, because he was a king, as well as someone who brought Christianity to Norway. Tell us about Saint Olaf as my initial candidate for a saint with a high body count.
Yeah, Saint Olaf, known as Saint Olaf the Stout, or Olaf II the Stout. He is the great-grandson of the previous High King of Norway, and then the Norwegians all said, I don't know if we need to have a High King. Maybe we should just have a bunch of nobles and fight over it all the time. And so he's one of those nobles from Ringerike, which is a nowhere land in Norway then and now, rises to petty lordship, and so therefore goes out a Viking. So his first bunch of known murders is when he sails to an island off Estonia, inhabited by the Osilians, and slaughters a bunch of them in a Viking raid. We don't know how many. It was a rich trading island. He probably didn't slaughter all of them because he had to leave with the solid gold goodies, but in the hundreds, let's say. On his way back, he fights a battle in Finland, the Battle of Herdalar. That's a draw, so he doesn't kill as many Finns as he would have liked. He's at the Siege of Canterbury in 1011 with a different Norwegian warlord, and that doesn't kill very many people at all because Canterbury's not well protected. Except it accidentally kills the Archbishop of Canterbury because they capture him and they're like, we're going to hold you for ransom. And he says, I have instructed my people to never pay ransom to pagans. Screw you. And someone maybe took that the wrong way and stabbed him. So there we are. I don't even know if it was Olaf that did that.
And we don't know yet if he's going to be the one who has the highest body count. But he's probably the saint who killed the highest number of archbishops of Canterbury.
Yeah, I think absolutely. If you're looking for saints who have killed archbishops of Canterbury, you're not going to get past him. Anyway, apparently this sets him to a thinking. And during a stopover in Normandy, which by this time is Christian, but still Viking, he is baptized in Rouen Cathedral by the Duke of Normandy himself. So this is in 1014. So he has been Christianized and he thinks, well, what does Christ most want me to do? I know, unify Norway and make myself king. So he goes off to Norway, declares himself king, and starts slaughtering everyone who says you're not king. And sadly, Robin, no one kept a list or even particularly good records, but if you extrapolate from other civil wars of the era. So the civil wars of the Frankish Empire in the 9th century, they kill about 1% of the population. The War of the Roses kills about 5% of the population of England. Those are both high estimates, I would say. So maybe he kills between 2 and 10,000 people during the course of his war to become High King of Norway. In 1026, he fights a battle against Knut of Denmark, who is the guy that runs England and Denmark and wants to run Norway and Sweden. He has a clever plan to open up the dike and flood the Danish ships and slaughter them all. It sort of works. It knocks out maybe 60 shiploads of Danes, but the Danes still have a bigger fleet. And so he and the king of Sweden are basically surrounded by mounds of corpses as they realize that this is not a good look for them, and they retreat. So it's a tactical success, but a strategic defeat by Knut. And so that takes some of the glistener off him being the king of Norway. He can't even beat Knut. And so he's driven into exile in 1029, and he comes back with an army of Swedes at his back to make him the king of Norway. And he's killed at the Battle of Stiklestad. His younger brother, or half-brother, I guess, Harald Hardrada, is at that battle as well. Hardrada is merely wounded, but the Olaf and Swede side loses, according to the sagas, 4,200 men, and the Norse defenders of Norway against their king lose 4,600 men. Those are saga numbers. They've done archaeology at the Battle of Stiklestad and said, guess how many skeletons and pieces of arrowhead there aren't at this battle. So it's probably closer to 420 versus 460 if you just sort of drop by a factor of 10. So he's died at Stiklestad, and is almost immediately, because he's died for Norway, everyone who hates the current king of Norway and Knut says, oh, he was a saint. He was trying to make us all Christian and good. We didn't know what we had when we lost him and drove him out. And so that sort of local sainthood was confirmed by the Pope in 1146. So Olaf is more valuable as a symbol after he is dead than he was welcomed as a high king when he was alive. But this happens to many of us.
Yeah, a lot of people seem more holy after they're dead. Yeah.
Right, after they're no longer stabbing you. So his largest possible body count by my numbers, and these are, you know, as I've clarified, not great numbers, is about 25,800 people, probably more like 9,500 people. And this is counting people he leads into battle and gets killed. If you just count enemies of Olaf, then his high number is 16,100 and his low is 7,580. And that's assuming that all those Danish ships had full crews, because that's where the majority of his body count comes, is in that cunning opening of the dike to smash the Danish Navy. If you assume they got out, then those numbers go down. But that's roughly how many people were on a Viking ship. And we can guess how many of those ships were destroyed. So it's in that neck of the woods, about 7,580 people.
So for a saint, that seems high.
That is a lot. Yes. Even your warrior saints, your Saint George, he barely killed anyone as a Roman soldier and killed a couple of dragons, which barely counts, I don't think. There was a whole Theban legion of saints, but they were martyred before they ever got to killing anybody. They were raised in Egypt. They were marched to Switzerland. And the general said, great, everyone sacrificed to the emperor and we'll go have a battle. And the Theban legion said, oh, we don't do that anymore. We're Christians. And the guy in charge said, well, then you're all dead. And so they never got to kill anybody, which is a shame. You have a whole legion of Christian saints, never killed anybody. It's a real bummer.
That does seem more like the attitude, as I understand it.
Right.
But it does turn out that there are other candidates for killing a saint.
One of the classic candidates is Saint Olga. She is a saint in the Eastern Orthodox Church. She is AKA Princess Olga of Kiev. And she is very mad at the Drevlian tribe, which is the tribe right to the west of Kiev. And they killed her husband, Igor. And she took that personal, as Michael Jordan would say. And so she invited them to the city. They said, how about you marry the king of the Drevlians since you suddenly are a widow? And she said, that's a great idea. Why don't you bring him and his court to my city? And, oh, I know, you'll be welcomed into the city by being carried in a big boat. And they carry them in a big boat. And then she says, okay, men, drop the boat in that ditch next to you. And they do. And then they buried them all alive in the ditch. And then the Drevlian said, there must be some misunderstanding. Didn't we send a prince to you to be married? And she says, well, I don't know. I don't see one. Why don't you send some more rich people to look? And we'll open up the town and let you all look. And so a bunch of rich people get there. And she says, you must be so tired and hungry. Why don't you come to this banquet that I've prepared for you? And they come to the banquet and she sets the building on fire and kills them all again. And by now the Drevlians have sort of, you know, copped to this and they say, well, we're not going to do that anymore. And she says, no, 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 let me come and explain. And she comes with her tiny retinue of men and goes to the Drevlians and says, look, let me just explain what happened. What happened? What? Well, you know, yeah, I see your glass is empty. She gets them all drunk, and then her men kill everyone in the welcoming party. And then her army shows up and besieges the city of Khorasan. And Khorasan says, is there a way we can make this problem go away? And she says, certainly. Just everyone in Khorasan send me 3 birds and I'll consider it a done deal. That'll be my ransom for your city. And they said, great. They sent her 3 birds. She tied fire to all the birds and sent them back to the city, homing pigeon style, and burned Khorasan to the ground. The traditional death toll of that alone is 5,000. I don't know how many people makes a Drevlian, but it's a lot of Drevlians that she murdered. So that's a good bloodthirsty sainting.
Now, did she then go and like repent and be holy? Or
I don't know that she ever repented.
Or was she once again celebrated for all of this murder?
She is converted to Christianity in Constantinople after that. But I don't know that she ever said, I'm sorry to the Drevlians. I feel like that was not necessarily a thing. That maybe, like Ashoka, she commits all those murders and then says, well, that's done. Now I can be peaceful and holy.
Right. So the murder and the sainthood, separate activities.
Separate activities, yes.
Repentance, we're not so sure about.
Not so sure about. But if we're opening the door to Orthodox saints, which, again, this is a choice, the all-time winner is going to be Nicholas II Romanov, who is canonized in 1981 by apparently a breakaway Russian Orthodox Church, but he's been officially canonized since then. And he killed 95,000 of his own people, including at least 2,000 Jews in pogroms. You see numbers an order of magnitude higher than that. And he mistreated German POWs to the tune of about 400,000, killing them. Killed a lot of his own people in various ructions and uprisings. So something in the order of, like I say, 95,000 outside World War I and another 975,000 during World War I. And maybe you don't put World War I on him, but you can certainly put the other 95,000 on him. And that is probably the record holder. But again, this is Orthodox saints and they're built different.
Right. So yes, I'm not the person one generally comes to determine whether someone is a saint or not. I'm perfectly happy to admit other Orthodox saints. But I do have to call shenanigans on this one because, as you said, the original canonization was part of a particular anti-Soviet propaganda campaign in 1981, super politicized. It's pretty absurd that they would consider him a holy anything. And the acceptance of that later by the Moscow Particulate, also super political. So I'm not determining whether he's a saint or not, but for the purposes of this question, I am going to take Nicholas II off the board
because
that's nuts. But there are still other candidates.
There are still other candidates. There is Saint Stephen of Hungary, who, once he becomes King Stephen of Hungary, fights a series of defensive wars against the Holy Roman Empire and the Pechenegs. And I think a defensive war, you can't really blame a saint for fighting. If you're invaded, you got to fight back. That's how it works. Theban Legion notwithstanding. But he also fought a war of unification in Hungary, which again, you know, same caveats apply to the Olaf's wars in Norway, but 1% of Hungary is a lot bigger than 1% of Norway. So you're looking at maybe 12,000 people dying in that war. Plus, he gets into his own head to fight wars against Poland and Bulgaria. In Bulgaria, he is sort of backdrafting off the Emperor Basil the Bulgar Slayer, who invades Bulgaria. And I mean, he's not a saint, but he definitely is in the running for killing a lot of people, you know, in pre-industrial methodologies. But St. Stephen probably helped, but he didn't really do the majority of the killing in that war. So my guesswork for him is around 15,000. So not as many as Olaf's high number, but bigger than his low number. But this is all guesswork. At the same time, his friend and ally, Henry II of Germany, Holy Roman Emperor Henry II, is also St. Henry of Germany. And as many, many nobles do who rise to power in Germany, he has to whack some people in various internal ructions. He is crowned a king of Italy in Pavia in 1004, and the locals of Pavia take exception to this. So his army moves in and burns Pavia. So he's sitting there in his new Italian crown, and his army is putting down the anti-King Henry riots with sort of energy, and they wind up burning the city down and sort of lightly sacking it. It's still his imperial city. So if you say maybe 10% of the city dies in the fires and sack, that's about 1,800 people.
I think if you're in the 10% who get killed, you're not thinking of it as, this is just a light sacking.
Right,
I guess
yeah.
I can.
Yeah, if you're one of the people, it's a heavy sack, no matter, even if the only guy sacked. And then he also fights a war with Poland that is all on him. This is a war that lasts for 16 years from 1002 to 1018. And the chronicles say that every siege, 500 Poles died. We don't know if those chronicles are particularly valuable, but each of the three invasions of Poland during that period wound up besieging three or four different cities. So you're talking about 4,500, maybe 5,000 dead Poles in this invasion. And then his own German troops that he's dragging into this stupid war, they number about 10 to 15,000 troops per invasion. He loses all three invasions. So one assumes some pretty severe losses on the way back. So again, assuming about a 10% death toll per invasion, you combine the 4,500 dead Poles with 4,500 dead Germans, you get a 9,000 total plus the 1,800 from Pavia. And that puts him up in low Olaf numbers because that's over 10K. Now everyone's saying, but what about Joan of Arc? What about the best warrior saint that ever lived? Because she is literally canonized for killing the hated British. And indeed, at the Battle of Orléans, she kills 4,000 hated British and Burgundians, not personally, although she wields a sword with a will. And the Loire campaign, she kills another 9,000 hated British. So that's a total of 13,000. And those are pretty reliable numbers. And then she goes and tries to besiege Paris. And King Charles says, don't besiege Paris. We're not ready to besiege Paris. And she said, God told me to besiege Paris. And then she lost the siege of Paris and got 1,500 French people killed there. So I think those should go on her numbers. The French people who died at Orléans or in the Loire, they're following God. This is her crazy notion, because obviously if God had wanted her to siege Paris, it would have fallen. That's just logic. So her total, if you add those 1,500 French, that gets us to 14,500, which is pretty good. And again, that's up to high Olaf numbers. But if you're looking at French saints who get people killed for no reason, the worst, much worse than killing the hated British, this is Saint Louis, Louis the Ninth of France, who led two separate crusades, the Seventh Crusade, 1248 to 1254, and the Eighth Crusade in 1270. And the Seventh Crusade killed at least 15,000 crusaders, because it was one of those crusades where you land and capture the port of Damietta in Egypt, and the Sultan of Egypt panics and says, I'll trade you Damietta for Jerusalem. And then you say, I'm not here to make deals. I'm here to invade. And you march into the Egyptian desert and are slaughtered.
I'm not here to make friends either.
Right.
I'm here to crusade.
I'm here to crusade. I'm here to crusade and chew gum, and chewing gum hasn't been invented yet. And so the Seventh Crusade, as I say, kills 15,000 crusaders on the march, basically depopulates the Holy Land of knights and an unknown number of Egyptians. We have no idea how many. There's no one left in Damietta when they seize it. And when they take Al-Mansura, they kill a bunch of people that are in Al-Mansura, but then they're besieged by the Egyptians. So just at a completely random 3-to-1 ratio, you assume maybe they killed 5,000 Egyptians, but that number is literally me guessing at a wall. So we know 15,000 crusaders are on his ticket. And if he only kills, Robin, if he only kills 1,100 Egyptians, which I feel like any crusade just does in the course of things, he's beaten Olaf's high record. And then in the Eighth Crusade, rather than sail to Egypt where they're waiting for them, they sail to Tunis for reasons that I don't even understand, and I'm not sure anyone really did, but they take Carthage, which at that time is a sort of a suburb of Tunis, and they kill everyone in Carthage. Now, again, population numbers for Hafsid-era Carthage are not easy to come by, but if you assume a sort of theory of suburbs from Tunis, which was about 100,000, you can assume there's at least 5,000 people in Carthage, and he massacres everyone in Carthage, and then everyone gets dysentery and dies, including St. Louis. But I don't know if dysentery counts as a body count, so I didn't count it.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you're going to start not just a war, but a second war on the same theme where you lost 15,000 people the first time, death from disease is a massive part of war, I'm going to put that body count on St. Louis.
You're going to count that?
Yeah.
Okay. In that case, Robin, the number of people brought to Tunis was about 11,000. So if you're adding those 11,000 to his death toll, then you have 15,000 crusaders he gets killed in the seventh, 5,000 Egyptians, just again at random, 5,000 Carthaginians. So that's 25,000. And then we've added another 11,000. So that's 36,000. So I feel like if you're adding the dysentery, St. Louis definitely takes the flag from any non-Orthodox, non-political saint.
Nobody else, not even Olaf. This is like 3 to 4 Olafs.
Yeah. And Olaf, you know, say what you want about King Olaf. He is not the guy who sticks around in an untenable situation. That's one of the reasons we love him, is he says, oh, I'm going to be massacred by Canute if I keep this up. I'm leaving.
And so was, and presumably he was canonized knowing the vast swathe of human misery that he brought about. And everybody thought that was great and rewarded him with sainthood.
Yeah, he's canonized in 1297, not that long after the collapse of the Eighth Crusade. He, I guess, was always very nice to the Catholic Church and was personally, you know, above reproach, despite being a king. He was a legal reformer, founded hospitals, cared very deeply about the poor, just didn't care not to slaughter them if they lived in Carthage, I guess. That was
didn't value human life at all, but cared about the poor. Sainthood.
Yeah. I mean, if we are asking to defend the crusade, everyone on the crusade basically volunteered. They said, I'm taking the cross, I'm going to go smite the paynim, and if I die, I'm going to heaven. That was the deal the Pope made. And if you were a knight at the time, you probably had a couple of questions about were you going to heaven, given all the other murdering you'd been doing. So it was probably a nice get out of jail free card. I feel like the crusaders at least knew what they were getting into. Now, slaughtering the Egyptians.
I may be back projecting, but I still disapprove.
You still disapprove. Yeah. I feel like we can disapprove of the Seventh and Eighth Crusade without necessarily questioning the value of founding hospitals and caring for the poor.
Well, now that we've numerically answered this question that everybody had on their minds but hadn't quite thought to ask, it's time for us to listen to an exciting commercial and head into another hot Andor segment. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Reward this podcast for the many clues it has given you by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Martin Rundquist,
Sikander,
Alexander Arabalo,
Derek Heimforth,
and Robert Wolf. The delight of book forayers, the unhappy groan of Ken's shelves, tell us that we're once more in Ken's bookshelf, which is the segment where we review all of the things that Ken has legally plundered with cash money and or electronic transactions from booksellers all around. This time around, we're going to look at some stuff that you picked up at the Strand. Plus, you've got a lot of books recently. Don't tell Sheila. And so I've sort of done a bit of curating on this list this time around. And I've at the end, I feel like we haven't had enough Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs books recently. So I raided some more of those from a different trip. But let's get to it, as we must always do in this segment, with Resurrection Alexandria, the Painted Greco-Roman Tombs of Qom al-Shukafa by Anne-Marie Guimier-Sorbet, André Pellet, and Mervat Sef-Eldin.
Yeah, these are basically the description by the archaeologists of a tomb in Alexandria from the Roman era, so post-Cleopatra. It's near Alexandria, and it was found in 1900. They, you know, lit it up and, you know, started taking photographs in 1904. So it's a well-known site. It's not, you know, particularly obscure. It's just that there's so much stuff in Alexandria that it sort of went under the radar a little bit. And so this is an example where the publisher and the scholars say, we've got these really great tomb paintings that nobody knows about. Let's make a big, pretty picture book of them. And who am I to say no to a big, pretty picture book of tomb paintings, Robin?
Does it include maps? Are there maps?
There is a map of the tomb, I think, in it, but there's not like a big map of Alexandria. But,
well, you know, many people will like the map of the tomb.
Even map better. Of the tomb. Yeah, that's nothing wrong with that.
God's Gold, A Quest for the Lost Temple Treasures of Jerusalem is by Sean Kingsley.
Yeah, this is despite the title, it is a pretty straightforward archaeological mystery. The notion being that at some point, the Romans sacked Jerusalem after the rising in 70 AD, and they carried off all the solid gold goodies to somewhere. And the where did they all go is the question. And we have sort of a chain of provenance a little bit down through the Roman Empire. But at some point, the gold gets lost or spent or melted down. And the question is any of it left, any of those temple treasures still around? And if so, where might they be? And that's what begins the sort of more speculative part of it. It's not quite, you know, conspiracy. It's not a treasure hunt. It's not your holy grails, but it is as close to that sort of material as you're likely to get from a real archaeologist with a real provable sacred treasure. And so it can be a pattern for your own artifact hunt, or you can decide, nope, one of the things that was in the temple was a demon bowl, and God made you keep it there so as to keep the demons out. And after 70 AD, well, look, everything's gotten much worse. And if we could find that demon bowl, we could unscrew it.
Next, we have a book that has a subtitle. It's Making an Argument I Agree With, Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention by Ben Wilson.
It's what it says on the jar. It is a history of the city. It is in the sort of pro-urbanist writing. You used to see urban scholars would write about cities as, well, what can you do? But Ed Glaser, among other scholars, has sort of turned that around. And people are now, you know what? Cities rule. They're great. They're where you can go see art house movies and whatnot. So this is part of that new flowering of, let's look at the city, not just as a benefit in the now, but let's see what role it played, you know, going back to, you know, Ur of the Chaldees. And this is one of those. I got a number of these sort of generalized history of the city, and this is one that fit in with that nicely.
Although one particular city might have had some crimes in it, because next we come to Crime and Scandal, The Black Plaque Guide to London by Felix Barker and Denise Sylvester Carr.
Yes, I don't know how official this is. The real London Tourist Board puts up what they call blue plaques. So if you want to find George Orwell's house, there's a blue plaque on it. Or if you want to find, you know, the place where Wat Tyler was grabbed by the king, there's a blue plaque for that. The Black Plaque is meant to commemorate, just as the name says, crime and scandal. And so I don't know if they exist solely, you know, in virtual space or if someone actually puts up a black plaque. I know that when I was in Whitechapel finding the Ripper sites, there were no black plaques on the wall telling me about them, but it's the sort of thing that this book covers. It's one of the many ways to do a fun street guide of London and emphasize the seamier side of the Great Wen.
Speaking of seamy, it's time to move to the espionage section. The Quest for Sea, Sir Mansfield Cumming and the Founding of the British Secret Service by Alan Judd.
I am not at this present writing. I am just about to do a straight up reorganization of the espionage shelves. It's been years in the making, but I do not know how many biographies of Mansfield Cumming I have. Obviously, it doesn't matter. If there's a new one, I want it. But maybe some of the older ones can top off the other side of the question now that I have this very strong looking contender for the best Mansfield Cumming biography. And if by some miracle that's the only one I have, great. But I'm pretty sure I have at least two more.
And for the uninitiated, Sir Mansfield Cumming was
the first head of MI6. And he used to annoy office visitors by stabbing himself in his wooden leg with a letter opener.
Oh, right. Stabby wooden leg guy. I remember him now.
Right. Yep.
Speaking of espionage biographies, The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies by Jason Fregone.
This is basically a biography of the cryptanalyst Elizabeth Smith Friedman. She and her husband worked as cryptologists initially for a guy named George Fabian, who wanted to get her to solve the codes in Shakespeare's plays and prove that Bacon wrote them. And so she was hired to do that. And she met while she was on staff decrypting Bacon's plays or Shakespeare's plays, a different guy who was a plant biologist named William Friedman. So love bloomed. And she did a ton of practical cryptology. And when the war began, World War I, Fabian and the Friedmans, of course, volunteered to help stop the Hun because they were the best cryptanalysts in America. And sure enough, they done did that. They set up the only cryptographic facility in the country is this guy's library full of Bacon manuscripts and Shakespeare folios. And it was called the Riverbank Lab. It's a great story. They're great, good fun. And she has a full and exciting life. But that's that's sort of the highlight for me is this wild turning a Liptony into counter-espionage. That's just magical.
Next, let's look at Negative Intelligence, The Army and the American Left, 1917 to 1941 by Roy Talbert.
Okay. This is basically the United States Army had a division that was in charge of monitoring troublemakers and political dissidents. And this went on with no particular attention to the doctrine of posse comitatus. And there was a division at one point called the Negative Division, which is where the title of the book comes from. And this is, of course, during the time of the first Red Scare under first Wilson, then Harding, and then continues throughout as Stalin becomes the big threat. Once FDR becomes president, he sort of dials that back a good bit, possibly because his own administration was riddled with communists, possibly because he figured the army had bigger fish to fry. Who can say? Maybe a little of both. But yeah, this is just good stuff for Trail of Cthulhu era stuff, good stuff for Call of Cthulhu era stuff, and just, you know, instructive part of America's domestic intelligence story.
I feel that spies with numerical code names will never catch on, but nonetheless, here's Agent 110, an American spymaster and the German resistance in World War II by Scott Miller.
Agent 110 is the code name for the great, the legendary, the king, Alan Dulles, who is the guy who eventually went on to basically found the CIA along with a couple of few other former OSS veterans. But he is the brother of John Foster Dulles, who became America's anti-communist Secretary of State under Eisenhower, very wired into the Washington power structure, and a delightful figure just in terms of the sort of closed-off, deeply intellectual personality that he had. He's a wild choice to be in charge of America's spying, and this is the part where he is working with the German resistance. He was part of an attempt to get the entire German command in Italy to defect, basically to surrender without any orders from Hitler. You can ask how close that might have ever been to happening, but I suppose Scott Miller is going to make the best of it because this is, you know, Alan Dulles, the hero years before he makes all of the American left from our previous entry mad at him.
And to update the espionage shelf a bit, we come to Sandworm, A New Era of Cyber War and the Hunt for the Kremlin's Most Dangerous Hackers by Andy Greenberg.
And this is just what it says. This is about the cyber intelligence arm of the GRU, I assume, as well as If the SVR has one, good for them too. But cyber intelligence is one of the things that you need to do in the world. And if you're not good at it, then you are almost ipso facto a second tier intelligence agency. And so therefore the Russians continued their tradition of being a A tier or even S tier intelligence agency by being really, really good at cyber intelligence. And this is a book about them with an aspect, I think, of criminal investigation as well. But still, a distinction without a difference, certainly in cyber intelligence in general, and certainly in Russian cyber intel.
Well, let's give you a break to stop rearranging the espionage shelf and start rearranging the Elliptony shelf. We'll be back after this exciting commercial. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Cannon Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KENROBIN.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. And as promised, we're back in the world of magic with A General Theory of Magic by Marcel Mauss.
Yeah, this was originally published in 1902. This was a sort of a anthropological look at magic. It's not specifically a, you know, way that magic works type book, but it's sort of a example of what magic is and why it happens. And this was much on the minds of anthropologists. Mauss is someone who believes that there's no such thing as sorcery, specifically a solitary magician, because if you're being a solitary magician and no one believes you're a magician, you're just a crazy person. So it requires a community to believe in magic for magic to be a thing. And this, you know, notion of why communities believe in magic became sort of the target of his questions of anthropology, because he was basically trying to get away from materialist questions of anthropology and saying, look, tons of things happen in society that have no material component or that are badly explained by materialism. We need a mechanism to explain that. And magic was one of the clearest examples for him of a non-material aspect of society. So that's why he was curious about it.
Next, we come to The Dream Culture of the Neanderthals, Guardians of the Ancient Wisdom by Stan Gooch.
Stan Gooch is a guy who I have got a couple of books on. He has a fun book on the magic of the moon. And here we have the Neanderthals, who are the original noble savage. You can't get more original than the Neanderthals. And as we all know, the Neanderthals were a peaceful, spiritual group of people who lived in harmony with the earth and communicated by telepathy and had so many other wonderful things going on with them. And bad old Cro-Magnon man killed them all off. And that's why they're bad. And Gooch is very much in that sort of new age woo-woo school of belief that the farther back you go, the more pure and beautiful everything gets. And this is yet another example of that. And I have a lot of time for Stan Gooch. He's great fun. And Neanderthal dream time is a pretty great concept by itself.
And now we have an item by Richard Wingate called Atlantis and the Amazon, Lost Technologies and the Secrets of the Crespi Treasure.
The Crespi treasure was found by a guy named Father Crespi, or actually he was in Ecuador, and the locals got to know him, according to his story, and gave him these wonderful golden tablets. And the golden tablets show a bunch of, one assumes, magical things from some other tribe, because why would the Cuenca give him their own magic? But anyway, he took that treasure, and ever since then, it has been one of the many things that people use to find ancient astronauts or wonderful magic or whatever kind of elliptony they're looking for. Or in this case, I suppose, Atlantis, because Atlantis in Brazil has been a long-standing and beloved belief. So this is Wingate taking the old Crespi treasure for a spin through the ancient technological Atlantis theory that Graham Hancock and other people have re-propagated.
An author I'm familiar with, but not a book I'm familiar with, Mitch Horowitz brings us Uncertain Places, Essays on Occult and Outsider Experiences.
Again, this is, you know, you know as well as I do, Mitch Horowitz is a well-known historian, pop cultural specialist on the occult. This is a collection of his essays, so, you know, even if many of them are stuff I've already seen, something is going to be new, and it's all going to be at least somewhat sourced and point in interesting directions. So just a good book to have for your Mitch Horowitz shelf.
If you're nowhere near Delphi, but you still want to predict the future, you might pick up The Oracles of Apollo, Practical Ancient Greek Divination for Today by John Opsopos.
I'm going to go on a limb and say that John Opsopos is not going to suggest slaughtering a bullock and looking at its liver. I think that this is going to be one of the sort of, you know, look at birds type things. Maybe you're going to burn bay leaves and inhale them. I suppose that could happen. But this is, you know, standard neo-pagan stuff. And it's, since it's specifically attempting to modernize the rituals of Apollo, that seems like a necessary thing to have and to know. So I was happy to pick it up.
This one sounds more serious-minded. The Business of Alchemy, Science and Culture in the Holy Roman Empire by Pamela H. Smith.
Yeah, this is an actual book from Princeton University Press. Real book, real historian. This takes a specific career of a specific alchemist, a guy named Johann Joachim Becker. He's a 17th century alchemist. He has a lot of intellectual interests, and he also has to sell stuff to stay alive, and he has court influence in Germany. So Smith is taking Becker as sort of the type of the 17th century alchemist who is trying to provide both a economic benefit to his clients and a political benefit to the emperor without ever actually having to turn lead into gold, which would be hard. So it's a rigorous study of a real alchemist, which tends to be fun-ruining by its very nature, but it should at least give me lots of good hooks and ties. And again, the 17th century is a great time for gaming, even if it's not quite the greatest time for alchemy.
The Complete Lenormand Oracle Handbook by Caitlin Matthews.
Yeah, the Lenormand is a 36-card deck. It's not a tarot. You might call it a taroka because it's basically the same notion, because it's cartomancy. And it was designed by an 18th-century fortune teller named Mademoiselle Lenormand. Did she exist? Who can say at this point? But her name gets attached to these cards, and they were, tarot light. They were the second best. Have you tried the tarot and been disappointed? Try the Lenormand cards. And that is as true now as it was in 18th century France. Caitlin Matthews, by the way, is a very well-known New Age author and is generally fairly reliable in, you know, presenting sort of mid-case occult stuff pretty well. So good for her.
Next, we have Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men by Joseph P. Farrell.
Okay, where we begin by praising Caitlin Matthews, we begin by deprecating Joseph P. Farrell. He is kind of a gross neo-Nazi. Do not buy his books new, but he is also a relentless systematizer, and he is putting all of his sort of occult stuff into this big map of secret NASA conspiracies and hidden powers and all kinds of. So if you're looking for a sort of a dark web of the modern elliptony, Farrell has been doing it, and this one is about the genetic heritage of aliens, which has been buried into our DNA. It's been buried in the various hidden giants that get winkled out in caves in Afghanistan or dug up in the American West in the 1800s, anywhere where there's nothing so gauche as documentation. And this is taking that body of lore and snapping it into his ongoing dark web of creepy speculation. Again, he does systematic work. He is also someone you should not give a nickel to straight up. So by him used, if at all.
And finally, this time around, we come to When the Earth Nearly Died, Compelling Evidence of a Catastrophic World Change, 9500 BC, by Derek Allen and J. Bernard Dallaire.
This basically argues that there was a comet, possibly, that blew up over the Earth in 9500 BC, and it caused huge changes in the world. This is sort of warmed over Velikovskianism, the notion that the sort of changes in Earth climate that historically happened right around 10,000 something BC, actually closer to the canonical date for Atlantis, just throwing that out there, are basically, he moves them 1,000 years forward for, I'm sure, reasons, and ties them all to a single event as opposed to the generalized climate shifting that the Younger Dryas created across the globe for about 2 or 3 millennia. The Gulf Stream turns off and turns back on, for example, is one of the things that happens right around that time in actual geological history. So what better than to blame a comet for it?
Well, now that we've blamed all the comets, I think it's time for us to, I don't know, clear out of here before they get revenge on us and strike us. But we'll be back another week with more of the similar. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from rampaging saints by joining Schutz backers as
Brian Malcolm.
Donovan Herter.
Taylor Harless.
Matthew Preston.
And Michael Bowman.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.